I'm really excited today because I've been wanting to have a broader conversation about the subject that we're going to discuss today, which is moral theories, which might sound incredibly boring, but I actually think it's pretty interesting how even for those of us who care a lot about making the world a better place, we often don't really think about why something is better or why something is worse. You know, we have these intuitions, and maybe that's fine. Maybe we don't need to think too much, and that's actually going to be one of the things we discuss together. Is it actually necessary to think too much about these things? And, you know, or is it the case that there are some, like, hard cases where you have to decide between torturing a child and, you know, letting the child's father set up a nuclear bomb? But for all intents and purposes, it's pretty obvious what the right thing to do is. But even it's not even obvious, really, when you think about it, why right and wrong matter. And you'll hear there's some pretty interesting disagreements because Eric, Matthew, and I had a really fascinating conversation in my apartment, like, I think well into the middle of the night, honestly, a few months ago, where I was like, yeah, this is something everyone should think about. But to give you a preview, there's two dominant theories of morality. One is deontology and the other is consequentialism. And those are fancy words, but deontology, I actually looked this up. Do you know what the definition of deontology is? Do either of you know? I'm cheating because I looked it up right before this in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
Maybe not a very formal definition.
So. Yeah. So there, it's based on Latin, and it literally means the science of duty. So ology means science. You know, there's various ologies, psychology, you know, and so on. And then deon is Latin for duty. So it's the study of duty. And as you might guess, deontology is a moral theory that's based on duties. It's not based on any examination of the consequences of the impacts of our actions. It's just based on a kind of abstract analysis of what our duties are in a particular situation. And this position is one I think Eric will represent in this conversation. But the other dominant moral theory is consequentialism, which is in many ways the opposite of deontology in that instead of trying to think in the abstract about what's right and what's right and wrong just is dependent almost entirely on the impacts of what you do. So even something as seemingly horrific as killing someone can be right under consequentialism because, for example, there could be a situation where someone is a terrorist who's going to set off a nuclear bomb and kill, you know, a million people in San Francisco, and the only thing you could do is kill him. And someone is a consequentialist, like I think Matthew, although I want to prejudge how Matthew would examine. Would you agree with that situation?
Yeah, if killing them, if you're pretty confident.
Wow. So abandoning nonviolence already, Matthew. Let's kick him out. He's not. No, I'm kidding. We're not going to kick Matthew out. But, you know, so there are these two dominant strands, and if you ever talk to fancy moral philosophers, you'll probably hear those terms. But they really just have some common sense, intuitive applications, too, and we'll talk about them a little bit today. And the specific reason it came up for me was because Harvard University was just outed as performing these pretty awful experiments on baby monkeys where they suture their eyes literally shut. And there's some horrific images that have come out, not from Harvard's experiments, but from similar experiments over the years. And it's just vile what happens because it does like psychological, physical, all sorts of damage to these primates. But they justify it and they really do think it's moral. And Harvard University as a whole made this really resounding statement, not apologizing for it, not saying, oh, you know, we understand the moral reservations and it's a complex issue and we're apologetic that some people are concerned about this. No, they just came out guns blazing saying, no, we're right because we're saving lives and therefore it's justified. So a very, no offense to you, Matthew, a very utilitarian consequentialist position. And this is particularly disturbing to me because the specific class of patients they used to justify their experiment was people who've died of a brain cancer called glioblastoma. And in Priya, among other people who know me well, will tell you, that disease has taken a very heavy toll on my family. My mom died in 2015 from glioblastoma. And so it just really burned me when I read that. Because I know my mom, if she heard that her disease was being used to justify torturous experiments on monkeys, I mean, she would be outraged. She would be out there protesting with us, banging down the door at Harvard University and trying to convince them to release these monkeys. That's kind of a preview. But I'll start with this. For both of you, I'm just kind of curious, why does morality matter at all? Who wants to take that one?
You want me to start?
Why does morality matter to you?
I think morality matters because it's a way of thinking about what we value deeply. And if we don't have any values, there would be nothing to do. It wouldn't matter if you did if you just lay in your bed or if you went out and protested, yeah. It wouldn't matter if you did anything at all, or even if you just took care of yourself at all.
Yeah.
So can I ask you a more specific personal question?
Sure.
When did morality start mattering to you? Because I know you think a lot about this a lot. I think about this a lot. I've had lots of conversations with you about it. So was there a point in your life where you decided, hey, I care about morality and I want to think about this more?
I think morality has always mattered to me at least a little bit. You know, even when I was young, I care about how I interact with other people and, you know, whether or not I make them feel happy. And so to that extent, that has always mattered to me. But when I really thought about it more formally was, I think, probably maybe in my senior year of high school or my freshman year of college, when I started, I was leaving religion at the time. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure I was doing was having a good sense of morality yeah. that wasn't any more founded on a belief in God.
So there's a gap kind of left by your leaving religion?
Yeah, and I was aware of that gap. And I was also talking to a lot of religious people at that time, and that was a common question that they would ask me.
Yeah, yeah, because a lot of religious people, one of their first questions when you leave a religion or you say you're not religious, and I'm not particularly spiritual. I mean, I identify as Buddhist, but to me, it's not a religion, it's a philosophy. A lot of times when you don't have a spiritual religious belief, people will ask you, well, how do you figure out what's right and wrong? And it's nice to have some answers for that for those of us who don't believe in any particular religion. So let me throw that question at you too, Eric. Like, why does morality matter to you?
Yeah, so I think generally humans have the ability to like make choices with what we do. And so a natural question is, what makes a good choice? And this has been a question that philosophers have pondered since the beginning of Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy too, I'm sure. And I think that's sort of where we get our foundations for morality, just mm-hmm. like, how do we ground what makes a good decision versus a bad decision? And
so I guess the question for me is, why does it matter to you? Why did you decide it matters? Because there's lots of things people are thinking about.
Right. I
mean, you're a chemistry PhD.
Mm-hmm.
You think about chemistry, or you thought about chemistry a lot. And I think you still think about chemistry to some degree.
Right.
My guess is no one else in the room thinks at all about chemistry, even though they're very clear right and wrong answers about chemistry.
Right.
You know, so what is it about morality that made you decide, hey, this is something I want to think about quite a bit?
I think I first started thinking about morality really deeply when I was in high school. I was on the speech and debate team. And so as part of debate, we'd like literally debate these topics of morality. And so really got used to thinking about these topics deeply, learning about a lot of the philosophical concepts that are out there, and really having a dialogue during those years. And so that was a very formative experience in terms of my moral education.
Was there a particular debate subject that really motivated you and made you think, hey, wow, there's more to this than I thought. I can't just rely on the things people tell me. I should actually be independently trying to figure out what I think about these things.
I think I felt that way about every topic.
Really? Like, interesting.
I mean, you have to argue both sides. So even when you think you have an intuitive sense of like what the right answer would be, you have to sort of learn the other side. And then you realize that it's a lot more complex than that. And then you're having this debate with other people. And so there's always so much depth to, and the topics are of course picked so that there'd be a lot of depth.
Yeah, it's interesting. The two stories you just told, one was leaving religion and going to university. One was being a student in speech and debate, remind me of something a Stanford sociologist once told me, which is, I was always under the impression that morality mostly just comes from social norms, just because descriptively that seems pretty accurate. If you grow up in India, you're probably going to be Hindu or possibly Buddhist, possibly Muslim, depending on where you live. If you grew up in the United States, until fairly recently, the odds are you would probably be Christian. And so I always thought, okay, it seems pretty clear morality is based on just, you know, the social norms of the people around you. But one of the things this Stanford sociologist told me is that actually people are not as affected by social norms as you might think if, and this is the important part, if they have time and space to reflect, right? And that's fairly new in human society, because through most of human history, people have just been dependent on, you know, their day-to-day activity to survive, right? You can't just say, I'm going to spend a year thinking about speech and debate, or I'm going to leave my religious community and just like reflect in this weird place outside of my home that we call university and just think about things for 4 years. Like, that actually hasn't existed for most of human history. And so one of the reasons people are actually able to make independent judgments and form independent identities is because they actually just have space. And it never occurred to me. It's kind of self-evident. It seems obvious after you hear it. But at the time, I was like, wow, that's actually pretty interesting. And it made me think, for those of us who are trying to create change, one of the things we have to do is give people that space to think, mm-hmm. you know, because you just don't get that many opportunities. The other thing about that that's a little tough right now is that I feel like with the economic crises we're going through and like all the pressures so many people are facing right now just to survive, it's really hard to find the space to reflect. You know, even in university, like we have a lot of either university students or recent grads. I think you're a fairly recent grad, right? 2 years ago?
Yeah.
About 2 years ago? Cheyenne is recent grad, 2 years ago? 1 year?
This year.
Dean, other people. And, you know, I think probably from what I've heard from Dean, at least, it sounds like most university students are not feeling that they'd like to have a lot of space and time to reflect. It's a lot of stress and pressure. Is that fair, Cheyenne? Yeah. Dean, would you agree with that?
I don't even know what it would be like. I can't even answer.
I mean, I guess, actually, Belinda, you graduated recently, right? Did you feel like you had space and time to reflect and decide what you thought about things in college?
Probably.
Yeah. So that's weird, because I had the same experience you had, where university was like a really wonderful experience. Like, I jumped around between all these degrees. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to study, but who cares? I'll just like study where the hell I want because it's interesting. And it sounds like you had that experience too. Is that a fair characterization, Matthew?
Yeah, I think I had a fair amount of time to reflect.
So why?
I don't know. I guess for my first year, I was into computer science, and mostly everything that I learned there was something I just picked up from personal programming.
Huh.
So that might have given me some space.
Classes, you already knew the... You already knew all the answers.
All the computer science ones. Okay. There were some math and science ones that were new, but that and just I made time for it as well. Like, it's something that personally interests me.
Huh.
Like, I like talking about philosophy and morality.
Yeah.
And so it was one of the things that, you know, I considered to be almost like an extracurricular activity.
Interesting. Yeah. I wish we had more. I mean, one of the things we're trying to do with this space, and even just like this specific event, is to give people some time and space to reflect on things and think about things and learn things. Because I just think there are so few spaces where you're just asked to pause and just think about what you believe. I mean, it just, and if no one actually gives you that prompt, that's one of the great things about university, at least good universities. And, you know, I definitely felt that way about my experience at MIT. Like, mm-hmm. there were a lot of bad things about it. It was a dreary place. The architecture's horrible. The weather's even worse. But it was a place where our teachers, in my experience, was that your experience?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, like, the people there are all so.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and even you're studying one thing, but your professors really do give you the space to think about other things. And I think that's important, like mm-hmm. that interdisciplinary attitude. But I feel like right now, I mean, partly just because economic pressure, but it feels like I have to get a job. I have to get a well-paying job. In San Francisco, I have to get a job that has six figures, or how do I even pay rent? You know, it's like, it's just no longer the case. You can say, no, let me just spend some time doing the things I want to do and thinking about the things I want to think about. I don't know.
Yeah,
what do you
for
think of
sure.
that, Eric? Did you have that time and space?
I think I made that time and space, but you're definitely right that I think there's a lot of pressures and stresses in life that keep people away from this sort of opportunity to reflect.
Yeah.
I think the other side of it is that never has it been easier to distract yourself.
Yeah.
And so there's so many other things potentially competing for your attention and reflection. And I think that's another possible reason why it may be more difficult these days to reflect on these important topics.
Yeah, no, I definitely think you're right about that. Well, let's move on to the substantive question then. I mean, mm-hmm. Eric, how do you determine what's right? That's a big question. Matthew's like, I'm glad he asked Eric first. It is a big question, but...
Yeah.
But I thought your way of thinking about this was very distinct, especially mm-hmm. within animal rights, and especially among tech people, because you're a software engineer at Google. Mm-hmm. And I think, were you surprised when you found out what his ethical system was?
I don't know. I guess maybe a little bit.
Yeah, because I feel like most tech people are like, you know, they like thinking about expected values and mm-hmm. probabilities and, you know, utilitarianism. And, you know, you're a math and science person who does like way fancier math than anyone I know right now. Just in your spare time, Eric does like weird proofs that I don't understand. Just in his spare time. But you have an ethical viewpoint that is very kind of non-empirical.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay, so tell me about it. How do you determine what's right?
Yeah, I think probably one of the most important influences in my ethics is Immanuel Kant and his categorical imperative. And so I feel very strongly...
And this is a German philosopher, right?
Yeah.
He was German? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I feel strongly that there are these sort of moral truths, maybe, that you can sort of intuit from a situation that are independent of the consequences. And there are different tests. There's a notion of rights that you can't just use another as a means to an end.
Yeah.
And then there's also these sort of logical ways to think about, like, whether... universalizing your sort of maxim and your action in a situation would be contradictory. And so I think that's another useful maxim in determining whether something could be ethical.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember reading Kant and thinking that was such a powerful insight, that this idea that the basis of morality is the notion that all of us are not means, we're ends. You know, each of our lives are intrinsically valuable. Mm-hmm. Our freedom is intrinsically valuable. And when someone instrumentalizes us, like turns us into commodity to turn into utility. No, I'm just kidding, Matthew. but I mean, this is the critique of utilitarianism, right? If you're thinking just about consequences and suddenly everybody around you is just kind of a means to an end, like achieving more joy in the world or utility, and you can make these really Faustian bargains and weird, dark trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And my view is, I don't know what your view is, I think most people probably agree with you. Would you say that's accurate?
I think in
terms of what they think about morality.
I think a lot of people sort of have a hybrid of views. Yeah. I mean, the trolley problem is a classic example of trying to get a sense of where people fall on the issue. And I think the statistics are like 90% of people will kill the one person to save the five. And so that sort of...
Well, tell us about the trolley problem. Sure. And actually, what is your answer to the trolley problem? But first, tell us what the trolley problem is.
Yeah, sure. So the classic problem is you have a trolley going down the rail, and it's going to strike five people and kill them if nothing happens. But you happen to be standing at like some sort of switch, and you can divert the trolley onto another rail. Unfortunately, that other rail also has an individual who would die in the case that you were to divert the train. And so... it sort of sets you up to make this decision whether to sort of passively let these five individuals die or make some active choice that causes an individual who wouldn't have otherwise died to be killed as a result.
Hmm. And so what's your answer to the problem as someone who thinks that we cannot use any individual as a means to an end?
Yeah, so I take the more passive approach and don't want to actively... kill an innocent bystander.
Interesting. But yeah, and tell us why. Because if 90% of people say, yeah, you should switch to the other railway and kill one person rather than five.
And I will say that there's like other variants of the problem that are less skewed. I think the way that the problem is framed, it almost sets it up to make a natural mathematical...
Yeah, you almost have to choose the one.
But I think there is... harm that naturally happens in the world, and that's sort of unavoidable, but to actively kill somebody in this case, I think, is a much weightier thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe another example that will resonate with people who may be inclined to kill the one person is whether you would harvest the organs of a healthy person to save five individuals. It's in a way very equivalent, and yet people give very different answers to that question. And
So explain that real quick.
Yeah, sure. So
because every human being is like a organ body.
Exactly. So
a bag of organs.
An analogous problem would be if you have like five patients who need an organ transplant, otherwise they'll die. And then you have a healthy individual who has organs that could save the lives of these five individuals. So in this situation, would you let the five individuals die and the one healthy guy live? Or would you harvest the organs of the healthy person to save the five lives, killing this innocent bystander in the case? Yeah. And in that framing of the problem, people overwhelmingly will not just butcher this healthy person.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that people give these different answers to what should be sort of equivalent situations, there's a good phrase for it. I forget it. Something like a moral illusion or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that to be consistent in your morality, you should choose like the same answer in each circumstance.
Yeah, for sure. So actually, let me pass that to you then, Matthew. Do you think we should be consistent in answering those two questions? Do you think they're identical scenarios?
I don't think these are the same questions.
Okay, please.
I think it's easy to frame them like they are.
Okay.
But so you take the trolley problem. It's just five people or one person, and that's all you're asking is, given the chance, should five people die or should one person die? I think that's clear enough. One person should die if it's just that chance.
One person should die.
Maybe I could
very clear.
I could phrase it more positively. Yeah. Four people should live.
Yeah, four people should live.
One person is guaranteed to die at least, but we can save as many people as we can.
Yeah.
But with the doctor problem, we have to make all of these extra additions to make it make sense.
Hmm.
So you have to be a doctor in an isolated woods that no one's ever going to go to.
Yeah.
You're never going to get audited. No one will ever find out about this. This won't
change
you in
any way.
Why can
no one ever find out?
If anyone ever found out about it, then we're bringing real-world problems in. Nobody's going to go to the doctor if there's a chance that your regular checkup
just your doctor's
ends
kill
in you,
you
being harvested for organs.
Yeah.
And
so you're saying there's other consequences that we're kind of intuitively including in the situation with the harvesting of organs that make us very much against harvesting the organs that are not relevant in the context of a trolley that could go careening in one path or the other.
Yeah, the lesson in the trolley is don't stand on the tracks, but that's the same for both sides, right?
Okay.
And the lesson in the doctor problem is don't have your own organs fail, right? Not don't go to the doctor.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe there is some analogous situation if you said maybe
so, like,
people
let me just
should
ask you this.
Okay, yeah.
If you really could have this happen just one time and no one knows about it and it's out in the woods and it just happens to one person, like, and you're that doctor, you're literally the doctor who's saying, God, I've got this patient who came to me in the woods. No one knows he's here. No one knows what I'm about to do to him. And I've got these other five patients. Two of them need kidneys. One needs a heart. One needs a liver. One needs a pancreas. I know if I get these organs into those five patients' bodies, I'm going to save all five of them. Do you think the right answer is to kill the person?
Yeah, probably.
Really? All right. Because it's analogous to the trolley problem.
I mean, what I always try and think of it is, imagine you had to be every single person in that scenario. Which scenario would you want to happen?
Yeah, for sure.
Right? If I had to be five people five times, one person five different times, and I got to live, and then I had to die one time, I would rather be in the scenario where the doctor saved the five.
Yeah. So I would guess that you would answer that question differently, though.
Yeah.
So if you, because Matthew's trying to have us imagine we're everybody, basically.
Sure.
And I think you're kind of doing the same thing. That's kind of what Kant tries to do with the categorical imperative, which we didn't actually really describe.
Sure.
Can you describe, like, your understanding of the categorical imperative? This is this concept that Immanuel Kant came up with to help us understand at least his theory of morality.
So my response would be that I'd rather live in a society where my life isn't contingent on the possibility that more people wouldn't be benefited from my demise, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so one critique of the situation is that obviously you're using the individual as a means to an end, literally taking their life to save other people.
Yeah.
But another perspective from the categorical imperative is that there's sort of the contradiction here that if you are trying to save somebody's life by taking a life, then it sort of undermines the whole notion of, like, life being valuable.
Respecting life. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you have to say to that?
I think whenever we talk about this, people will sometimes say things like, and you did, I would rather live in a world where.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always think is, imagine that the categorical imperative, imagine if deontology just always brought you to, like, a really bad world. Like, what if respecting everyone's values, it just turned out that that was a really horrible way to structure things? Or sorry, respecting everyone's life, or treating everyone just as an end in and of themselves. If everyone was always really unhappy in that world, I think people would generally prefer not to live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a good heuristic to treat everyone as an end in and of themselves. But I think that's because it tends to work out better for people.
Yeah. So maybe let's make this concrete. A world where everyone's miserable and we're treating every life as an end in and of itself. Let's make the terrorism and torture example even more egregious and say that not only are terrorists going to set off nuclear bombs, but they're going to set off napalms that slowly burn in a slow and agonizing way, like millions of people. You know, and you know that if we kill 100 terrorists, we will save millions, and in fact, hundreds of millions or billions of people from slow, torturous napalm deaths because we disrespected these individual lives. Like, that would be an example where most people would probably say, yeah, I mean, kill them. Like, that's kind of what the United States does. We even actually go further and kill people even after they've committed terrorist acts, like Osama bin Laden. I think the entire country was celebrating. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know. What did you think of that? You probably disagreed with it. Or?
Your thought experiment or killing Osama bin Laden?
That's Osama bin Laden.
I wouldn't say I know enough about the situation to say for sure. I mean, it seems like, speaking without enough knowledge, perhaps, yeah, it seems like generally if somebody wants to threaten the United States, there needs to be some amount of knowledge that the United States is going to come after them.
Sure. Okay, some point, so like right? Deterrence effect.
Yeah, there's some deterrence there. And then also, I don't know if he was planning on anything else.
Okay. Well, let me throw that example at you. Say that there are, we know there's 100 terrorists in the world. Each of them have some horrible, actually, let's call it, you know, a dirty bomb, you know, a nuclear weapon that doesn't kill people from incineration, but just causes a mass amount of radiation sickness and all the people are exposed and they'll all slowly die these painful deaths from cancer. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of people because each of these 100 terrorists has like a few of these dirty bombs. Would you say in that situation it's not justified to kill these 100 or 1,000 terrorists?
I'd say a lot of terrorists are motivated in the first place because of actions that United States justifies in the name of the greater good.
Fair enough. So you would not kill them?
I don't think so.
Interesting. Okay. Well, final question, then I think we'll open things up for folks who have other thoughts. But how did your respective ways of thinking about morality lead you to animal rights? So maybe I'll start with you, Matthew.
Sure. Well, I just looked around and I realized I was really only paying attention to how humans were being treated, right? Whether they were happy or not. And that there was no reason, there's no basis there. The question isn't is animal a human or how smart they are. The only thing that matters through that lens is, you know, can they feel happiness? Can they suffer? And so at that point, I think animal rights is the only conclusion you could draw.
And that's because your basic value system is it's good when we create more flourishing and happiness, and it's bad when we create more suffering.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And I think I remember you telling me there wasn't even any particular specific book or documentary or interaction. It was more just reflection, right?
It was
thinking about it.
There was a lot of watching things online. I was a big follower of Sam Harris as I was leaving religion.
Sure.
And this is something he talked about a lot as well.
Yeah, and he's actually moved in that direction pretty interestingly. Because Sam Harris is, I mean, to his credit, like a lot of people critique him for various reasons, but he's been open-minded enough to directly address the issue that factory farms are causing probably more suffering than any institution in human history. Mm-hmm. Like at least direct suffering for sure. And he's not someone who's like conventionally progressive. He's not like some sort of woke activist. In many ways, he's like an anti-woke person, but he's come to the conclusion. I'm pretty sure he's vegetarian now, right?
I don't know. I haven't really followed him so much recently.
He's concerned about what happens to animals. What about you? Like, how did your Kantian perspective lead you to animals and animal rights?
I think it's more just a shift in my understanding of animals, essentially. By default, we sort of raise with the notion that humans are the only persons in the moral sense that we need to regard. And I began to question the potential personhood of animals, non-human animals, and found that I couldn't justify, you know, exalting humans as, you know, some sort of special person and non-human animals as non-persons. And I think once you accept that non-human animals can be persons, it doesn't matter what your moral framework is, whether it's deontological or utilitarian or consequentialist, as soon as you consider them in your moral calculus, I think it leads you to vegan.
Yeah. No, that's a really good way of putting it. Once you realize that animals are persons, that they count for something, everything does change. Ezra Klein has made this point, and the original name of the podcast was The Green Pill, because Ezra Klein coined this concept of taking the green pill based on The Matrix. Has everyone seen The Matrix? Have you seen it? Like, apparently in The Matrix, I don't think I've watched the entire movie, like, in one setting. I've seen pieces of it just because it's culturally so important. So apologies if I get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure what happens in The Matrix is Neo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Neo? Okay. So Neo is in The Matrix, which is this virtual world that the evil machines have convinced us all that we're living in this paradise, even though we're being exploited and used as batteries, and is given a chance to take the blue pill or the red pill, right? And the red pill is the one where he gets flushed out of The Matrix and he sees the world the way it is. And Ezra Klein has said, once you realize that animal suffering matters, it's like taking the green pill. And everything in the world suddenly seems dark and disturbing. Mm-hmm. Like everything from the shoes people are wearing are from the skins of sentient beings. The milk people are drinking is from the torture of a mother whose baby was torn from her within hours of birth. And obviously the flesh that's being eaten everywhere is like a corpse. It's like this really dark transition to the world. And he said, he's talked about, and I think this is true for a lot of us, how hard that is when you take the green pill and you start seeing things this different perspective. But another point you made that was really valuable and interesting is it almost doesn't matter. Like, we've engaged in a pretty interesting intellectual conversation, but I also think it's fascinating that both of you, even though your viewpoints are in many ways diametrically opposed, both of you reach the same conclusion. I will say, I don't think it's just Eric and Matthew. I think a lot of great thinkers in these different domains, like probably the most prominent deontological thinker in the world right now. I mean, there's an argument about that, but do you know Christine Korsgaard at Harvard?
Somewhat.
Yeah. So she's probably the most famous Kantian thinker, I think, because at least when I was a fake student in philosophy, she thinks the categorical imperative is the way to think about things, that, you know, morality is based on our duties, not based on consequences. And she's written about, I think this is literally a quote, how human beings need to get out of the business of predation. That this is one of the duties we have, not to be predators of other living beings. And then obviously we have Peter Singer, the more traditional, you know, animal rights approach, not even approach, but just the more famous and well-known animal rights thinker who supported us in this trial and has been just hugely influential in the grassroots, who's a utilitarian who thinks, well, no, I'm not saying that there's some categorical imperative that says we can't hurt animals. I'm just saying that these animals can suffer and therefore it's wrong to cause that suffering, unless you can make some convoluted argument about how there's some benefit that outweighs the massive suffering we're causing. So some of the greatest thinkers on all sides of this debate have all concluded that, you know, as long as you think animals matter. And I think one of the interesting things is I think intuitively most people actually do agree with that. The problem is they don't actually reflect on what that means. Like, what are the implications? If animals really do matter, what are the implications for our society, for our economy, for our food system? And that's why I'm really grateful to have you all helping us reflect. Okay, I want to open things up for other people. Who else is as fascinated by moral theory? And actually, if you have a question today, what I'm going to ask you to do is just come towards this mic and say it into the mic, all right? Because we want to get it recorded.
So suppose you have one person you could kill, and that wouldn't save any lives, but it would improve quality of life for a lot of people, say a billion people. So in other words, you kill one person, and, you know, let's say it wouldn't be in a way that other people would assume that they would be killed as well. So just one off thing. And that increase the happiness of a billion people by, say, 1% on average. So would you say it's justified to do that?
Wait, could you say the second example again?
No, it's one example.
Oh, it's one example. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can kill one person, and everyone else is happy.
And
so
that increases.
Get rid of Kanye, and everyone's like, "God damn, thank God he's gone."
Well,
I'm just kidding.
Let's say there's some kind of a medical experiment you can do that requires killing one person, but that would, and it wouldn't save lives, but it would increase
everyone happier,
like happiness by and 1%, not by much, but
a tiny amount.
Yeah,
yeah. So maybe Kanye is a good example. Honestly, I feel like it's enough people are annoyed by Kanye. They're like, "I wish he were gone." All right, Matthew, what's your answer?
Yeah, I think if that was, like, say that was your only way of increasing happiness for a billion people. Yeah, it's, I mean, as phrased, it's kind of intrinsically positive as phrased in the problem.
Yeah.
I don't think it's pretty easy to think of thought experiments that are like this.
Yeah.
But I don't think they come up so much in the real world.
Yeah.
I think that's why they run so counter to our intuitions.
Sure. Yeah, fair enough. Any other thoughts? Yeah, please, you want to go over there?
Can you tell me your name again? I'm totally forgetting.
It's Peter.
Peter, great. Yeah. Please talk into the mic and bit about a fist away.
Okay, so it's kind of following up on that. Is there a point where, so say, if in relation to like, say, animal products or consuming animals, if there was a point where, say, we could determine whether or not animal products, say they did have they improved people's lives to a degree, say that was the case, what would be the point at which it would not be okay? So like, is there a percentage, say, so, or like in another example, if killing animals meant we would be 98% happier, better off, would that be okay to do that? Or if it was 50%, if it was 20%, what would be the percentage?
Yeah, what's the threshold for you, Matthew?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people actually do feel this way. They have some concerns about killing animals, but they also think, oh, but it makes my life better, you know?
I think one of the clearest examples of this is a lot of drugs have like a little bit of some animal products in them. And those are like, you know, things that can make a pretty big difference in your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
More so than animal products most people think of. And, you know, I've met a lot of people who are vegan and would say, you know, sometimes that's not something that they're as concerned about.
Yeah, well, for example, vaccines, I'm pretty sure. I think most vaccines include some eggs, right? Am I wrong about that? I don't even know. Did the COVID vaccine have eggs in them?
I believe so. I know the flu vaccine for sure. Most of it is made with eggs. There is like a variant of the flu vaccine that doesn't have eggs, but it's less common.
Yeah, you have to specifically ask for it to prove you have an allergic reaction. Actually, it's kind of curious that I don't know the answer to this, but does anyone know for sure whether the COVID vaccine had animal products in it? I'm surprised because I know a lot of animal rights activists were arguing about whether it was tested on animals, which it was, unfortunately. But I don't. Do you know?
Some
did have animal products. Yeah, it's weird because I don't feel like that was even a subject of conversation. And I don't know. I mean, what's your take on that? Like animal products in a vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think as long as you sort of, if you were to substitute a human for the animal, would you have the same answer? And I think it's possible that, like, I don't know, maybe you could harvest somebody's blood and use that to make some life-saving medicine. Could you justify that? Maybe.
Maybe.
And if so, then I don't see why something equivalent can't be done with animals.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, you've stolen my answer. I'm surprised that would be your answer, though.
Oh, yeah?
Seems like you would say no still in this situation.
I mean, it depends on the situation and what exactly is happening. But like for an unfertilized egg, it's not the same as like literally slaughtering an animal.
So the duty there might not be as obvious. The duty not to use the product. I mean, I kind of agree with this.
Mm-hmm.
This is controversial, but I do think there's a difference between eating animals and killing them yourself. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I think possibly. I mean, our consumer society is like so complicated that as long as you're willing to extend the causal chain far enough, you can tie pretty much everything to suffering and death.
Yeah,
and
I agree. But I think from a duty-based perspective, and honestly, even from a utilitarian perspective, if you're trying to create rules for society rather than just look at one individual situation and trying to analyze what the moral consequences of it are, there is a difference between causing direct harm and indirect harm through like a very complicated economic chain. I know that's controversial. A lot of vegans would say like, no, eating animals is killing them. But I think they are different. I don't know. What's your take, Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does something, you know, it would do something different to you if you were to personally kill an animal.
Yeah.
Right. Versus if you're, but you are asking a slaughterhouse worker to kill that animal for you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, but I guess maybe it does something different to them. You know, the 100 versus the 100 first animal that they kill.
Yeah.
Maybe not as big an impact, but there is still an impact there
that
you're asking someone else to take.
Yeah. All right, Priya, what are your thoughts? You have a big smile on your face.
Oh, I was just
observing our friend eating the chick patty.
I'm enjoying my patty.
Maybe to more directly make sure we've answered the question, though.
Have we answered the question, Peter? Because I don't think you have, actually. He said, what's the threshold? What's the percentage gain that has to accrue to human beings?
I think the percentage gain, whenever the, not percent gain, but whenever the direct gain outweighs the gain of whoever loses. And usually how I think about this is just to ask, if you had to be both people in this situation, would you? Like, if that was an option you could take. Like, if you had to experience the life of whatever animal was going to lose out, and whichever worker was going to lose out, and the entire, just a little bit of the very distributed impact of all of the climate change versus that positive impact for yourself. If that was the situation, whenever that flips to net positive, where you said,
I'd do it.
Whenever you said, yeah, I'd take that deal, that would be where I would say that's a moral action.
So it's like as if we were all, you know, reincarnated multiple times. And you know, like if we made this trade, I would be reincarnated as the animals a billion times, and I'd be reincarnated as the human beings who benefit from the animals 10 billion times. You live all those 11 billion or 20 billion lives. If you would, at the end of that, say, like, yeah, that was worth it, then it's justified. Does that seem like an accurate characterization?
Yep.
How do you feel about that, Peter? Yay, nay? Reasonable? No?
I think the problem that comes up for me then is how do we determine what that is?
Like, yeah.
How do we determine whether, because we can't live all those lives.
Yeah.
So I guess it would be each situation you need to have specific, I don't know, ways of measuring each one. And that doesn't seem like, how do we do that in the moment? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the big challenges to utilitarianism is it's so hard to calculate. You can never do it. But what I would say there is you just take whatever you think the expected impact would be and then account for the fact that you don't know. So like, let's say you click a button and maybe somebody who's unsheltered gets a meal, right? Or a tent or something like that. Or maybe somebody dies. You shouldn't click the button just because the fact that somebody might die is a lot worse.
Yeah, makes sense. Any last comment, question?
Is this just like an open floor?
Yeah, you can ask a question if you want. Just speak into the mic. We're talking about utilitarianism and deontology.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, question.
So what's your name again?
I'm Matt.
Matt, tell us your question, Matt. Can you talk a little closer to the mic, about a fist away?
Yeah. Hopefully this hasn't been answered before, but...
Please.
I have a question between the different species of animal.
Yeah, please.
Do we think they're all equally deserving of care of rights versus an ant, a bee, a cow, moose?
Yeah. Eric, what do you think?
I think that it's difficult to draw a hard line on where a non-human animal, which ones are persons and non-persons. I think we have very strong evidence that certain animals are quite similar to us, both biologically and psychologically. And where that sort of fades away is unclear. Personally, I try to err on the side of giving more animals the benefit of the doubt.
Yep.
But I think there are people who, in good conscience, can maybe make different decisions than I do about certain animals that are in this very gray area.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at that point it becomes as much a biological question as it does an ethical question.
Yeah. So you're talking about like clams, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know some very dedicated animal rights activists who actually eat clams and are proud of it. And they say, no, we should eat clams because, you know, they don't seem to have the neural apparatus to feel anything. And so we should show people that we're reasonable and that, you know, we're not against eating protein per se of a particular biological origin. It's just we're against suffering. I don't necessarily agree with that, but what's your thought on this? Not necessarily clams issue, but the original question Matt asked. How do you just tell between the species, and do you think all species should be treated basically similarly?
I think there's a quote that I wish I'd written down because it's like one of the most famous quotes. The question is not whether they think nor they, and I'm missing a part, but what do they suffer?
Yeah.
Maybe you remember the whole thing.
Yeah, it's Jeremy Bentham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think just that's the question is, you know, can they feel pleasure or pain? And then I think there is some additional question of how much pleasure or pain can they feel? And we should apportion how much we care about their interests to how much they even can care about their own interests.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I agree with you all there. I think that the lines are hard to draw, but the line that should be drawn is probably on their capacity to suffer. And sadly, for many animals on this planet, I think there's pretty good evidence even insects, for example, can suffer. So that's a tough one. All right. Well, thanks to everyone for joining. It was a lot of fun. And yeah, if anyone has any other follow-ups, I'm sure Eric and Matthew would be happy to chat with you on these questions and others. So thanks, everybody.